Anyway, so what I was getting at is in the Sonic movie, or where was I now? I'm totally lost. I'm sorry. In the Sonic movie, Sonic convinces Shadow your bad past doesn't have to convince you to be bad. And I think one of the things that our culture at large, like the broad academic culture, if you will, again, thinks there are no real bad guys. Like they're just victims, and so they don't so much deserve, I don't know, justice as they deserve understanding. And if you could just appreciate where they come from. And both biblically and just in terms of experience, I'm not sure that's true. I don't mean this mean, but I think there's bad people out there. There's just bad guys. And yeah, there might have been things in their life that led them to be bad, but at the end of the day, it's still their choice. You know, for me, the moment when it's absolutely clear that Anakin is evil, and he was evil, it comes out, is when he chokes Padme, because there's nothing left redemptive about him, because he's clearly showing he's out for himself, right? He can say, I was doing this for Padme, I was doing this so we could be together. But as soon as Padme is no longer what he wants her to be, you know, no rules, that kind of thing, no responsibility, he chokes her. And I mean, you know, it's a movie, but I'm just trying to make the point that there's bad people out there. There's just plumb, plain bad people. And we got to learn how to recognize them and deal with them. And especially in the church, Peter wants to protect us against people who would basically use the church to advance their own agenda and take advantage of people and stuff like that. So anyway, I don't know if that made any sense, but maybe one, I think it's in the Bible, but two, I think in our culture in particular, I think there is a tendency, I don't even know the right word, to heroize bad guys, or at least to empathize with bad guys. And so not to just put your foot down and be like, this cannot stand. And if it continues, there will be pretty bad consequences, if you will. Anyway, let's tear into the text proper. I had more, but I want to actually get into the text. So as you can tell, I didn't really do a I mean, I did do a fair amount of prep, but I didn't do quite as refined prep as I would have liked, because we've got one, two, three, four, five sections instead of three, and then an epilogue. But let's look at 1 through 3. And what I want to see in verses 1 through 3 is it kind of is a good overview. Peter just sets up. So false teachers are going to come in, and here's what they're going to look like. And then we'll tear into them more in verses 4 and following. But a lot in the first three verses, so just keep your eyes open for what are the characteristics of a false prophet, a false teacher. So if somebody would pick it up and read verses 1 through 3, please.
There were also false prophets in Israel, false teachers among them, cleverly teach destructive heresies, and even deny the master of the prophet. This way they will bring sudden destruction on themselves. Many will follow their evil teaching. Because of these teachers, their greed, they will make up clever lies.
Thank you much. Okay, there's a bunch of stuff in there, and a lot of it we're going to revisit in the rest of the chapter. But what do you see? And go for obvious stuff. This isn't a setup for a trick question. Just what are these guys like? They're here. I'm sorry? Yeah, verse 3. In their greed, wanting something from you, they will exploit you with false words. It's interesting. One of the characteristics, if I say dark triad or dark tetrad, does that like hit anybody? Anybody ever heard that thing before? It's this thing in psychology. I don't know if it's like a huge rage in psychology now, but it's a thing in psychology. The way that you identify a bad guy, a psychopath, is they have, depending on which psychologist you read, three or four characteristics. It's called the dark triad and the dark tetrad. But I'm getting somewhere with the language thing. One of those characteristics is Machiavellianism, which is a big fancy word. Machiavelli's the guy who wrote The Prince, if you're familiar with that. But Machiavellianism is the use of language for manipulation rather than imparting truth. Machiavellianism is using language not to impart truth, but to manipulate, to get others to do something that you want. You know, classic example, you made me do that, which of course nobody ever does, right? Like, you know, look how angry you made me. And then whatever, somebody, I'm going with a really extreme example, punches a hole in the wall or, you know, knocks something over and you're like, look what you made me do. That's Machiavellianism. Nobody made you do that. You are using that language to, now you don't say that in the moment. Okay. Remember, bad guys don't know, logic doesn't work with them, but they are using language not to impart the truth, but to manipulate people to get their own way. And now that I said that, let me think, what are the other two or three? So narcissism, they're very self-oriented. They are typically not empathetic. They just don't understand or care for other people's feelings. Machiavellianism, the fourth is sadism, but that's like the last one developed. Sadism, like you enjoy seeing other people in pain. I can't remember the third one. Jesus, if you would, help me remember. Maybe it is the lack of other people's feelings. Narcissism, psychopathy. Psychopathy is not being able to feel other people's pain or empathize. Yeah. Is that what, are you guys looking it up? Thank you for correcting. Okay, there you go. So thanks for being a good, respectful skeptic. So Machiavellianism, narcissism, psychopathy, and then usually after those three comes sadism, the enjoyment of seeing other people in pain. Anyway, that's not Bible. That's whatever current psychology, which may be out of vogue in 10 years or maybe actually true. I don't know. But the point is this whole focus on greed and exploitation through language, 100% right. Anything else anybody sees worth remarking on in the first three verses? Isn't that true? True. And we're going to get back to that when we get to verses 10 and 16, but not a very long timetable. You know, bad guys don't usually have very long-lasting relationships unless they're really hardcore manipulating, taking advantage of somebody who's just completely caved into them or whatever. But yeah, they're bringing on themselves swift destruction. It's interesting. I like RPG games, role-playing games, where you basically can pick whether you want to be a bad guy or a good guy. And it's kind of scary because if you look at the statistics, more gamers choose bad guy than good guy, I guess because of the appeal. But a lot of the RPGs I play, if you do bad guy choices, they come back to bite you later. Like, you know, when you get to the final battle, you don't have any allies left, or, you know, nobody comes to your aid, or you're just, you know, you might have had more power initially, but then you were weaker and you couldn't level up, or you didn't have this choice later. Whereas if you choose the good guy path, like you have all these, you know, allies and friends and all that stuff, it cost you short term, but it helped you long term. Again, that's not Bible. That's just whatever, gaming and life. But it's interesting to me that that observation hits even non-believers, if you will. But I think you're right. You know, they bring on themselves swift judgment. This is not going to work long term, if you will. Which, and I know I'm bleeding over for a moment and I'll get right back. Not that I'm like an expert on like whatever bad guys and psychopaths. I like psychology. So one of the things they teach you is about the outliers. And one of the giveaways, and this is especially painful for kids because this is where kids often get broken up homes, is families that move a lot. You know what I mean? They're constantly moving. You know, they go somewhere and they don't pay their rent for 6 months, and then they go somewhere else, so they disappear off the map and stuff like that. Okay, true. My apologies for not making that distinction. My point is they can't make any lasting relationships because they bring swift judgment on themselves. If they stay in one place too long, it doesn't take long for people to get onto their act and then for bad consequences to follow. And so they'll get away from those consequences. And it doesn't have to be families moving. It could be, I don't know, other things, changing of friend groups frequently, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, let's get back to the Bible. I'm just making an observation about the swift judgment thing I think is accurate. Of course, it's accurate. It's in the Bible. I'm just trying to give you examples of what that might show up outside the Bible as well. Let's keep going before I really choke on my foot. Anything else before we jump into verses 4 and following? Okay, so there is more there, but I think we're going to hit it as we go. So in verses 4 through 9, Peter's going to give us, depending on how you count, 3 or 5 examples of bad guys from the past. And he's going to use those, let's just go with 3 to make it easier. He's going to use those 3 examples to make 2 points. So if you would, keep your eyes open for the 3 examples and then for the 2 points, which I think you kind of already got because I cheated and put them on the board. I didn't cheat. You guys figured them out. But keep your eyes open for the 3 examples and then the 2 points. If somebody would, read verses 4 through 9, please.
for that righteous man on them. For his righteous soul. Then the Lord knows how to deliver. Then
beautiful. Thank you. Okay. So anybody spot any of the three historical examples, if you will, three Old Testament examples that Peter gives us? Okay, so that's verse 6. So he condemns the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, and this is why I said, depending on how you count, three or five examples, because the second and third example also have kind of a good guy example attached to them. So Sodom and Gomorrah got destroyed, and along with that, what's kind of the good guy example? That the Lord preserved Lot. He was kept, or he was rescued. Okay, more on that in a moment. Give me one of the other two examples, please. Okay, very good. So we had judgment on Sodom and Gomorrah that was horrific, but rescuing of Lot. We have judgment on the wicked earth with the flood, but rescued Noah. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. My apologies. Noah, and does he mention his family here? Okay. Thank you. And then the last example, which is the most obscure, the fallen angels. And truth be told, there's all kinds of ink spilled about what exactly that's about. But apparently there were angels who fell that the Lord has condemned to some particular region of Hades, hell, Tartarus, however you want to translate it, who will be judged fiercely at the last day. And like I said, that's not actually, we don't have that in the Bible, like literally anywhere. There's no text that says, you know, the Lord put these angels into, you know, subjection or prison or whatever. So that there's all kinds of fighting out there about what he's referring to. So I'm just going to say, I don't know. The easiest example is when the angels fell, when Satan rebelled, apparently some of those angels, for whatever reason, got locked up and are now being held for their final judgment when Jesus returns. Whatever is actually going on there historically, the point's pretty clear in all three examples, which is what he says in verse 9, where he gives us two points that he wants us to get out of that. Anybody see either or both of the two points for the three examples?
You can read 10, but 10 has
surprising
authority.
It does, but I'm not there yet. It's okay. Maybe I'm asking a bad example. So verse 9, or bad question, I'm sorry. Verse 9. So first point, the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from a trial, which is what happened with Noah and Lot. You know, I mean, it's kind of easy for us to read this and not think about it for a second, but I mean, Noah was surrounded by a world full of people so wicked, the Lord destroyed it with a flood. That must have been pretty rough. And Lot was destroyed by a city so wicked, the Lord destroyed it with a fire. And the Lord rescued him. In fact, I didn't hit on this, but it's worth hitting on. This is actually what hit me the most as I was preparing this lesson. Verse 8, by what he saw and heard, like in the city around him, that righteous man, Lot, while living among them, felt his righteous soul tormented day after day by their lawless deeds. So I'm going off script for a moment and coming back, but it just hit me, like, how much am I tormented by the wickedness I see around me? Like, I kind of, and maybe I'm talking to myself here, but I have this tendency as a libertarian to be like, well, that's, you know, that's their thing. That's what they chose. So be it. When really, if I'm going to follow the example of Lot, I ought to be pained by seeing people making these choices that I know are going to come back and hurt them. And not just hurt them. Let's not forget about the whole God thing. But is defaming God's glory. You know what I mean? Like when I see people engaging in whatever, extramarital affairs or people being overly greedy with money or, you know, engaging in drug habits, am I just like, well, that's their choice? Or am I like, oh, man, it hurts. Like, you get what I'm saying? Anyway, again, maybe that was just for me as opposed to you guys, but that apparently that's what Lot was like. The Bible doesn't tell us that in Genesis, but Peter says that. But the point is, going back to script, point is in verse 9, so one, the Lord knows how to rescue the godly. So Peter is telling us in his original audience, even as you're surrounded by these bad guys, the Lord is going to take care of this. He knows how to rescue you, so trust him. And then the second point in verse 9, have I given it enough to, for anybody to see what the second point is? Very good. God knows how to make things right, and he will see to it that justice is done. Which I don't know. I don't know if that comforts you. Sometimes people hear that and they're like, you know, that's kind of harsh. For what it's worth, and I don't know, this will probably come across cold, but if you actually ever have had something really wrong done to you or something really wrong done to your kids, like, that's a pretty sweet promise, as mean as it is. Like, God's going to see to it that justice will be done. He knows how to make things right. Like, in the end, nobody's going to get away with nothing. And I think that's beautiful because it assures me of justice, but it also takes it off my hands. You know what I mean? Like, this is a terrible example, and I tell this so that you'll laugh at it. It's a true story, but I tell this so that you'll laugh at it. Like, there used to be a time when I never road rage, but like I would follow people who did bad things on the road and stuff like that. And like if they were like pulling into Wendy's or something, like, you know, I'd pull in behind them and just kind of like sit there behind their car for like what the Sam? Anyway, but I was messed up. I was messed up, man. Messed up human being. But I don't have to do that. I mean, first off, a healthy human being shouldn't do that in the first place. But secondly, I don't have to do that anymore because God's promised to take care of it. I know that's a really small, bad example. Okay, but the point is, like, I don't have to worry about injustice. Like, when, I don't know, when kids tell false stories about me at school or whatever, I don't get recognition for this thing or the other thing. Like, I can just shrug it off because it's not that big a deal. In the end, it's the right is going to come out. And justice will be done, and I don't have to sweat it. Like, my job is just to keep growing in grace and loving God and loving people. And I can look at these examples like Noah and Lot and trust in that. So, big idea. Stay on it. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
One that sticks out to me is on the news, but every once in a while you hear about this horrific crime that was committed. Versus on the stand,
Good call, man. Good call. And where do you get the strength to do that? Promises like what we got here in 2 Peter 2. By the way, for what it's worth, I'm not saying to let people get away with doing wickedness. That's not loving either. You know, if we're really loving, we should stop people from sinning for their sake as well as God's. But I am saying, you know, unless we're some kind of duly appointed, you know, authority figure, there's no need for us to see to it that justice is done. You know, that's not your job, if you will. Anything else before we go to 10 through 16?
I don't have any for it. My mind. Maybe you don't agree with me, but I have those thoughts of, wow, I really wish that this would happen. But.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that's so beautiful about the Bible is the way it handles life like real life. Like, you can fall off the horse, if you will, on either side, right? On the one side, there's the, I'm going to indulge in thoughts of revenge and I'm going to get revenge or whatever. And on the other side, there's the, well, it wasn't really that big a deal and I'm not that important and I should just let it go. And neither of those are right, you know? And the Bible is beautiful because it satisfies the need for justice. That was a big deal. That was wrong. And your Father, who loves you more than you can love yourself and has numbered every hair on your head, is not going to forget, and he is going to take care of it. But that also means you don't have to. And both of those are just, I don't know, I just think that's, it deals with real life so beautifully. It doesn't oversimplify things, but it gives you the strength to like keep growing in grace, right? For the glacier of God's love to move forward in your life and you to grow the way Peter's telling you to. I think, good comment. Thank you. Anything else before we move on? So in 10 through 16, I think what we're going to see is Peter gives us more about the nature of these guys. And I've written animals. Basically, these guys are animals in that they are driven largely by their appetite. And Hallie's already alluded to verse 10. But I think what we're going to see, especially in verse 10, and then expounded beyond that, is the two characteristics of these guys is they're driven by desire. They basically run off instinct and appetite. That's what they're after. Filling their bellies, enjoying animal pleasures, power, that kind of thing. And they have no respect for authority. They are their own authority. They don't answer to anybody. So those are the two characteristics, I think. And guess what? That's kind of how animals act by and large. But we'll see. So if somebody would read verses 10 through 16, please.
They're stronger and more powerful. They're like unreasonable. Caught and destroyed, and like they choose to attack with harm for the harm they have done. Their idea of pleasure is to browse in broad daylight. They are blots and blemishes. Eyes full of adultery, they never stop sinning. They are experts in greed and a curse. Have left the straight way and wandered off, follow the way of Balaam, son of Beor, who loves the wages of wickedness. Wrongdoing by a donkey and animal without speech. Spoke with a human voice.
Thank you. Man, all kinds of stuff in there. Before I give you my thoughts, anything that particularly jumps out to any of you guys as salient or noteworthy? So this is, you guys might have, if you grew up in the church or whatever, been to VBS, you might have had this story. This is the prophet that Balak, the king of, I think it was the Amalekites or somebody. Anyway, when the Israelites were wandering through the wilderness and they were about to come into the promised land, there was some king that saw them, and I think it was the Ammonites. Anyway, one of the Ite brothers, the king hired Balaam to come and curse the Israelites. And Balaam shouldn't have gone, but he did. And on the way, three times, the angel of the Lord stands in front of the angel of the Lord stands in the road where Balaam is riding his donkey. But Balaam can't see the donkey. Balaam can't see the angel, the donkey can, and so the donkey moves out of the way, and Balaam beats the donkey, and the third time, it's kind of sad, funny, he's beating the donkey, and the donkey's like, why are you beating me? I've saved your life three times, and Balaam, I don't remember exactly what he says, but Balaam says, back to the donkey. Like, it's just funny. He isn't even like surprised that the donkey's talking. He just says back to the donkey, because you made me look like a fool and I'm trying to get here and blah, 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 blah. And anyway, Balaam figures out the truth. Unfortunately, he still goes. He ends up blessing the Israelites, but then he later gets killed because, again, he shouldn't have gone in the first place. So I know that was a really fast and poorly described thing. But I think the point of the story, at least I would offer, is, here's a guy who did it for the money. He was greedy, but it was such a stupid move that it took a donkey to rebuke him. Like, I think that's the irony, if you will. Like, even a donkey could have figured out this was a bad idea, and you needed a donkey to tell you this was a bad idea, because these guys are animals. Like, not in like the party sense of animals, but animals in terms of that's all they're driven by. You know, they're reckless. They revel in the daytime. I thought a lot about end of verse 14. They are accursed children. These guys, and I thought about this for us as we raise our kids, these guys need to learn to grow up. You know, so one of the things we need to teach our kids is look past just your appetites and desires to something bigger and better, and do have respect for authority. The authority thing is because these guys are speaking blasphemies against even angels. Like, okay, man, back off. This isn't really your place, kind of thing. Anything else you noticed that was worth commenting on? Okay, so I ran out of time, so let me bring it in for a landing. I think I'll just mention in 17 through 19, something that I think is worth noting is that they have this false freedom. Verse 19, they're enticing people in. I'll start in 18. Speaking arrogant words of no value, so there's the arrogance, they entice by fleshly desires, there's the fleshly desire, the animal instincts, by indecent behavior, those who barely escape from the ones who live in error. And here's what I'm going for, 19, promising them freedom while they themselves are slaves of corruption, for by what anyone is overcome, by this he is enslaved. So what they say is, indulge your appetites, enjoy life, don't answer to anybody, be your own person. But what they actually are doing is enslaving us and themselves to their own whims. You know, Bob Dylan's famous line, right? Everybody's a slave to something. Everybody worships something. So, yeah, you might call that freedom, but that's not freedom. That just means you're an animal that's just, you know, running after whatever the scent of the hour is, doing whatever your appetite says. And if a person's identity is reduced to their appetites, are they really even a human being anymore? And I think that's something worth thinking about. What is true freedom? Answer, true freedom is being enslaved to something that's going to give you the greatest life. And of course, what's going to give you the greatest life? Obviously, the Lord Jesus. So that's something worth pointing people toward. I think I'm going to hold off on the rest because there is more to say, but I'd sooner see you guys not have to stay here longer than you need to and let the poor kids volunteers actually be able to go home too. So part and thought for what it's worth. One, the most important thing we got to do anytime is to treasure Jesus. So for what it's worth, like, let's think about the one who was not driven by animal appetite, who time and time again denied whatever his appetite of the hour was, whether it was for freedom or pleasure or not going to the cross. And you want to talk about somebody who didn't have to obey authority but did? Goodness gracious, Jesus is like the opposite of these guys. You know, always speaking truth, never going after greed, always respecting authority, even authority you didn't even have to respect. Think of how he treated Pilate, you know, as he's there on his trial. So one, see the beauty of Jesus and realize how beautiful he is in contrast to these guys, and feed on that beauty and become more like him, help our kids to become more like him. Let me see if there's anything else that's just like so fantastic I got to throw it at you, but I don't think there is. Yeah, I guess I'll leave it at that. So keep your eyes open for these false teachers, what they look like, for us to be guarded as we grow in the Word, recognizing the characteristics, appeal, and fate of the false teachers, and stay close to Jesus as you do so. Probably wasn't good, but I hope it was helpful. Parting comments or thoughts before we call it a day?
I think we have more history than martyrs and stuff that up against communism. Mm-hmm. I just think we have more examples to pull from than even.
Good call.
It's relevant today, even with like church news, right? There's a lot more like progressive churches out there that are like biblical, but regardless, I think it's still really relevant.
It is. I will. Yeah. One of the things I hear from my kids the most is Jesus wouldn't want you to be unhappy. You can't serve Jesus if you're not happy.
And yeah, so, no, I mean, like, self that God himself, mm-hmm. like being, like, that's so evident today. Like,
yeah.
You need to live your best life, live your truth, mm-hmm. and all this.
Yeah, you're right. I read it in ethics a lot, and it's easy to pick on particular things, but you know, God would want you to be happy, so it's okay to engage in that affair, marriage, cheat on somebody, you know, whatever. And there's 100 other variations, right? God would want you to be happy, so you don't need to be loyal to this team, go where the money is, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, you're right. You know, but what's driving it? A failure to, or what characterizes it? Not respecting authority. And driven by an immediate desire, an animal desire, rather than something higher and greater, namely the glory of Jesus and the love of people. Good call. That's true. Anything else? Let me pray us out. Holy Spirit, help us to be a people who are guarded. Unfortunately, until you get back, there will be bad guys of all sizes and stripes. And today, hopefully, we've considered what the bad guys will in the church could look like, and give us wisdom to spot them, give us wisdom in handling them, give us wisdom in not becoming them. May we be a people who respect authority, who do not live for animal instinct, who live for you and help others to live for you. May we grow in such grace. Save our kids early and soon. Meet the needs of all of the different people in this room. May we exalt you as we go. In the name of Jesus Messiah, we pray. Amen.